All right, again, so we are in 2 Kings chapter 8 and 9 and hopefully 10 tonight. We'll see how the pacing goes and a couple ground rules to begin with. Having become less dumb than I was on Sunday, the goal is for me to not do much of the reading of the text like I tried to do during the sermon, and so that's going to help everybody out. So just prepare for that. And if you catch me not reading, just raise your hand and say, no, I should read that. It's probably for the best. But we're going to try to look at the text as much as we can and pay some close attention to what God is doing here. If you'll notice, and you may have seen this earlier in looking at some of the stuff we've covered so far, in that, let me see if I can, there we go. We had this earlier representation of how the structure of chapters 4 through 8 lay out, really kind of tying together or helping us understand and see what takes place structurally in God is teaching us about Israel. That's going to change, though, when we get into the following chapters. But right now, chapter 8, it is in some ways a bit of a capstone of this entire cycle that starts and closes with much of the same individuals in primary focus. It does shift a little bit as the story continues. What's going to happen, though, and we'll see this, is it's going to kind of shift to a story that is about Jehu and Hazael, or Hazael. And these stories here, again, begin to tell us much of the same context for Israel and for Judah as these nations are crumbling into their pieces. The context is how the people are affected by the leadership that is slowly losing its foundation in God. There's an erosion that takes place. The erosion is larger at different segments. There is some attempts to kind of shore it back up, and those are very one king centric. When that happens, there'll be a single king, and he's identified as being more righteous than the ones before him, sometimes even more righteous than more than a few people before him. But the trend line is very consistent, where there is, we used to be here and now we're going downward. That's the general trend line. And there's a couple of social factors that play into that. There's a power dynamic that plays into that. But all of it is underscored by something we've talked a lot about, which is the rejection of God and the rejecting of his covenant. Ergo, the consequences are seen in Israel proper and then Judah proper as two separate entities by this point. But realize that some of it's kind of obvious. I mentioned that social impact. When Israel's power decreases, that vacuum is then filled by all the pagan nations around them. And so David had pushed the borders out really far. As they schmoozed in tighter and tighter, you then began to see the consequences of that. When you see, and let's kind of scoot to this one real quick, these sections of the nation which were once heavily powered by Israel as a whole people, now are slowly being separated. And so right now we've got, for this time period right now, the northern and southern kingdoms still in existence. But you'll notice that these edge areas, Syria, Ammon, Moab, Philistia, Phoenicia, that's the chunk that's already been chewed away by the nations around them with the reduction of power. And so that slow erosion is going to continue to manifest itself until where you'll have nothing left. All right, so let's pick our nose right into chapter 8 real quickly and start with a reading of verses 1 through 6 of chapter 8. And so, Michael, you want to start with that for us, please?
He said 8, 1 through 6.
Yes, sir.
Now, Elisha had spoken unto the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, arise and go thou and thy household, and sojourn wheresoever thou canst sojourn. For Jehovah hath called for a famine, and it shall come upon the land 7 years. And the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. And she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. And it came to pass, 7 years again, the woman returned out of the land of the Philistines, and she went forth to cry to the king for her house and her land. Now the king was talking to Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me, I pray thee, all the great things that Elisha has done." And it came to pass, as he was telling the king how he restored to life him that was dead, and that, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life cried to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son, whom Elijah has restored to life." And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed to her a certain officer, saying, "Restore all that was hers, and all the fruits of the field, since the day that she left the land, even until now."
All right, so we pause right there and we think about this. Does this story have a familiar echo anywhere else in the Old Testament? Is there something like this?
Elijah.
What was that, Roy?
Elijah did something similar to that.
Right, there's a similar Elisha and Elijah connection here. I always have to be clarifying. Elijah came first and Elisha is our second one. What else? Is this similar to something else? Anybody else have everything taken away to the point where they were moaning, complaining to the Lord, and then it all came back?
Job.
And you think about two factors when we think about Job: theology, knowledge about God's character, person, and teaching, and then practicality, how it affects Job and his family. So on the theological knowledge of God and God's ways side of things, when we think about Job, what do we learn in the text of Job? What are some of the big principles we see from Job? God's faithfulness and consistency might be one of them. Bobby?
Job held to his belief even though he was tried pretty severely.
Job's pressure cooker was on high. And he seemed to demonstrate quality conviction in the midst of that. Does he ask questions?
Yes.
Does he ask the kind of questions that seem difficult to think about? Yeah. Matthew?
Satan has power in his life to take away the
story. Satan is not, at least in the way the story is presented, bound aside from whatever limiter God places on him. God said, "Yes, you can do it." So there's a limiter. We don't know what power he had beforehand. We do know he was granted greater access. We also learned something else about Satan. What's a little side point we learned about Satan?
He couldn't take Job's life.
Couldn't take his life. That was restricted.
He knows God.
He's interacting with God in the text presentation. That's a unique kind of thing there. Because think about this. Where else does that happen?
Garden.
We find it in the garden, where there's an interaction between created things, which is where I would place the serpent, the deceiver, the devil, and the creator. And so that's going to cause us to think about all of those things whenever we read through it. When we see an echo of that in the story of God's people, we should pause and say, these are similar. How should I consider these events? What should I think about them? What does this inform me about God? What did this inform Israel about God? What did they know? What did they learn?
In both of them, with Job and with this woman, she's blessed more than what she left. I mean, he's granting her not only her land and her home, but all the betterments that were made to it since she's been gone for those 7 years.
Yeah.
Same thing with Job.
Yeah, she got more on the return side than she had on the front end. I got you a second, Matthew, verse 2.
Also learn from the temptations and the interactions that Christ had with Satan when he was trying to tempt Christ, and the answers that Christ gave back to him.
Right, when we move forward in the New Testament, which we'll do this tonight some, we'll see a lot of this kind of wind itself together. Matthew? Right, that's where this kind of this goes to the, again, now we're in the practical space, restoration of physical goods and all that, but it lifts back up into the theology space, which includes our questions about spiritual things. But there's one more connection here that's important. Israel is about to do what? What's going to happen to both the northern and southern kingdom? They're about to have everything taken from them. The kind of captivity they think only happens to the heathens, to the not us people, right? And then their shame is so severe that how does the Bible describe in different terminologies their shame?
What do you mean?
Well, the Bible will describe their entrance into captivity with terminologies like your nakedness has been exposed, your shame has been exposed. A trail of blood surrounds the, however you want to picture the caravan that goes off into captivity, because so many of their people were killed when they all thought two things would protect them. And that's important to see here when we get the resolution side of what happens to her and then the rest of this text. What two things did Israel think they had? They were the sons of Abraham and God. And with that, they can always just buy a little bonus thing. You know, if that doesn't work for us, we can always just partner with one of the nations around us. But in so doing, they reject God. That's their play. That's their standard behavior. We'll either trust in God, kind of, or make a treaty with the most powerful nations around. And when they start doing that, those treaties fail over and over again. They end up being to their destruction. And so that's that backdrop that brings such great joy when the final thing happens. But what does the text begin with? We had this great joyous moment. But chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, what is the Lord calling for? Famine. They're going to have to get into the pressure cooker for a while. That's part of the visualization and the intertextual need here, that it's not going to be immediately better. There's going to be a picture that comes through that famine. And we've recently read through last year, and we kind of studied through Nehemiah. We've looked at Ezra in different contexts. And so we kind of remember the restoration side. And that wasn't super just awesome easy, but it had great joy, right? Great joy when the temple was rebuilt. Great joy when the gates were hung. Great joy when the walls were rebuilt. And so this kind of brings that whole picture together and helps us then move the story forward a bit in our hearts. It then shifts. Verses 7 through 29. We're not going to read it all at once. But we still have that same Elisha space here. And let's do this. Let's read verses 7 through 15. And Les, would you read that for us?
Yes. Now Elisha came to Damascus, and Hadad, king of Syria, was sick. And when he was told him, the man of God has come here, the king told Hazael, take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. When he had came and stood before him, he said, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from this sickness? And Elisha said to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die. And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed, and the man of God wept. And Hazael said, why does my Lord weep? He answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, you will kill their young men with a sword and dash in pieces their little ones and rip open the pregnant women. And Hazael said, what is your servant? Who is but a dog that he should do this great thing? Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria. Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said to him, what did Elisha say to you? And he answered, he told me that you would certainly recover. But the next day he took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face till he died. And Hazael became king in his place.
Is that a nice positive message? Positive mental attitude right there, right? No, it's awful. This is part of the section of the text where it returns to some of the things we heard when we read through Judges. If you remember what Judges sounds like, Judges sounds like the fall of the kingdoms in some senses. Did you ponder for a moment how much is being brought to Elisha? Does that sound familiar? Back in 2 Kings 5? Think about this. 40 camel loads of goods. I don't even know how much that is. Like I tried to figure out, kind of wrap my brain around how much that would be. Does Elisha care about money as far as we can tell? Doesn't seem to faze him in the ways that everyone around him thinks. Because if we ask the question, does everybody around Elisha think money matters? Seems like a whole lot of them do, even some of his servants. But he doesn't seem to care about it at all. That's a lot. The bottom line, this is again just a massive amount of money. Much more than any one individual that's not royal, that's not a king, is going to be around in their lifetime. Second question, and second interesting aspect, is Elisha goes. Textually, this is Damascus. Elisha is like, compared to Elijah, Elisha is the Where's Waldo of the prophets. Because he's like never in the same place. And he's like, why is he over here? The text doesn't worry about it the way we do. Like, I wonder, like, why is he over there? Text says he goes over there and interacts. And so there's a Israel-related, a Judah-related, a God-related reason for him to be out. Very similar to when he just shows up in Moab. Hazael is historically likely identified as a son of nobody. That means he has no dynasty. He doesn't come from royalty according to the records outside of the Bible. And his ruling time frame is around 842 to 806. And he has a tremendous amount of power kind of in that middle space of time relative to others. But that has some questions here as we think about the text that goes through here. What is going on with Elisha's commentary regarding how people will recover, what they get to know, and what that all means? Why did he tell him that he'll recover? This is back in verse 10 where it reads, and Elisha said to him, again, it comes off verse 9, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from the sickness? And Elisha said to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover. But the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die.
Maybe he just wanted him to die happy.
It's something to think about. Like, okay, is this new for the prophets, by the way? To know what God is doing, but not tell what God is doing? No, it's actually pretty common for the Elisha space, right? Sometimes it's intentional as they're tricking the outsiders. This one, there's no explanation given. It doesn't really give us a qualifier there. I think there's maybe a little bit of what Les is talking about of, hey, it's going to be okay. But I also think this is not so much about him anymore. It's not about this one king. This is helping us see this other subtle plot taking place. Yeah, I think it's more about Hazael than it is about Ben-Hadad. And this is his behavior now coming forth, because the summary here is someone who will murder Israelites when he becomes king will also murder a Syrian to become the king. And whether you want to think about, does he imply that Hazael will kill him or should kill him, is a secondary thing. The thing I then key into, and I think we should too, is Elisha's response to it. He's not joyed by this. There are times when it seems the prophets are happy to speak for the Lord. This is not one of them. He weeps. Maybe this is a form of justice. I think that's probably a fair thing to think about too. But it does tie into something else. 1 Kings 19. Elisha will be a prophet. Hazael will be king of Syria. And Jehu will be king of Judah. They will all then unite to destroy the wicked of Israel and Ahab's house. But they're all surprise choices in some ways. Because you're seeing the decay of the people of God and the decay of the kingdoms. They're not the ones that people would have wished to have been in various places. They would have wished for Elijah. They would have wished for others. Last part of chapter 8. There's two chunks of it. Begins right now with verses 16 through 24. Let's see. Roy, do you want to read a little bit for us? That section, please.
And in the 5th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, being then king of Judah, Joram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign. 32 years old was he when he began to reign. And he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and did the house of Ahab, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for David his servant's sake, as he promised him to give him always a life and to his children. In his day, Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah and made a king over themselves. So Joram went over to there, and all the chariots with him, and he rode by night and smote the Edomites, which camped compassed him about, and the captains of the chariots and the people fled into the tents.
To verse 24.
Yet Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah unto this day. Then the remnant revolted at the same time. At the rest of the acts of Joram and all that he did, are they not written in the books of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Joram slept with his father, and was buried with his father in the city of David. And Abiathar, his son, reigned in his stead.
Did you notice how the introduction to this section changed in its form? Before, we've had these back and forth. Okay, now Elisha goes here. That's how it begins off. Or there's going to be a famine be called. We've returned to the standard king structure. This is their historical model. And you look again, verse 16. In the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, whom Jehoshaphat was king of Judah. So you have this shift, a hard shift in the language. That is in part a key that we've shifted a little bit from prophetic space to political space. And so that's something to pay attention to whenever you see that introductory shift that matches how all the earlier chapters have been in 2 Kings and 1 Kings. When you have that introduction, we're no longer talking about the prophet's work. It's going to be about leadership issues, kingly drama inside the royal house. And some of the things that happen here, as we kind of think through it, we begin to see the real scattered level of leadership in the kingdoms. Because you no longer have this dynastic power of growth. It's a king for a little while, another king for a little while, a king for a year, a king for a couple of years in both of these kingdoms. Even when we were to move forward and think about verses 25 through the end of the chapter with Ahaziah and Joram, they get little blurbs, little small segments. And I brought the map back up here because you're going to see them beginning to have trouble specifically identified with the nations that they balance up against. If you want to put it in boundary sense and kind of think about how the cycle has played out, when there was Saul and David, what drove their rise to power? God placed them in that position to take dominance over the Philistines and to push the Philistines out. They reached the zenith of the kingdom, let's say, for our purposes right now, in Solomon's reign, right? David bought it with blood. Solomon soaked it with gold. You can think about it that way in your head to kind of remember those two settings. Now, as they're on their decline, we've kind of visualized a little bit of that here, these rough outlines. Well, now you have those nations around that have been pushed out, in essence returning, being empowered again. Israel deals with Ammon, Judah deals with Moab, as they want to push back into that space. And it happens in this really broken leadership cycle. When you have kings that only last just a few years. And many of them bring a lot of baggage with them. They do just like their ancestors do. You think about Jehoram of Israel, a son of Ahab. He doesn't do anything different than his predecessors had done. Any questions or comments here on chapter 8 as we kind of summarize that last chunk? Thoughts are of importance to each of you? All right, cool. We got 15 minutes so that we can get into chapter 9 a little bit. All right, so we're going to read first verses 1 through 3. And Matthew, could you read that for us, please?
And Elisha, the prophet, called one of the sons of the prophet and said to him, "Get yourself ready and take a flask of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth Gilead. Now when you arrive at the place, look there for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, and the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him rise up from among his associates and take him in the inner room. Then take the flask of oil and pour it on his head, and said, 'Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel. then open the door and flee, and do not delay.
Seems pretty simple, right? Very similar to 1 Kings, I think, chapter 13. Don't linger around. Get out of there. Flee. There's all kinds of possibilities as we think about this. But let me ask you a foreshadowing question if you've read ahead. Do you think he's going to follow those instructions? Do you have confidence in his ability to follow? You know, here's the simple list. Take this flask of oil, go to Ramoth-Gilead, find Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, get him in the inner chamber, anoint him with oil, declare, "Thus says the Lord, I announce you king over Israel," and get out. It's a pretty simple list, right? What are our odds of success? Now, some of you probably read this again recently, Marilla Details, but based on what we've seen, do you think this is going to be a story of him doing exactly what he's told? It's okay to be wrong, too. Like, the answer is, it doesn't seem like it, right? Now let's pause for a second, too, and think about these instructions. What do they kind of infer? Would you want to be anointed king right now? Some of us are like, I would never want to be king at any point in time. But like right now, it doesn't seem like a great time to be anointed king. If you had just been reading, how many of you at one point or another watched the movie The Princess Bride? Like, it was standard viewing requirement for young Christians in my era. Like, you just had to watch it at least two or three times. I don't know why that was. It just became the thing that everyone watched. I want you to think about that from the standpoint of how all of this kind of lays out. And then think for a moment what it would be like to be in that story with the way that the Princess Bride story is laid out for you. Like, I don't like these stories. I don't want to be part of them. And then you get sucked into it. But then you remember how many awful things happens to everybody in those stories. It doesn't resolve itself to the end. By the way, this doesn't have a Princess Bride-like ending. If you're hoping that it does, it doesn't. All right, so verses 4 through 10 now. Let's see. Bobby, do you want to read that for us? Thank you, sir.
Okay. So the young man, even the young man, the prophet, went to Ramoth-Gilead, and when he came, behold, the captain of the host was sitting, and he said, "I have an arrow to thee, O captain." And Jesus said unto Peter, "Call us." And he said, "To thee, O captain." And he arose and went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head and said unto him, "Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed thee king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. And thou shalt smite the house of Ahab, thy master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel, for the whole house of Ahab shall perish, and I will cut off from Ahab him that is against the Lord, and him that is shut up and left in Israel. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jezebel, the son of Nebat, and the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel and the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bear her." And he opened the door and fled.
So there's a lot of similarity right there, but is there something different? He did the things, right? But did he do anything extra? That speech is a lot longer, right? So there's a couple ways we can think about this. Either you can accept my foreshadowing and say he didn't do what God told him to do. That's a fair reading of the text. It's also possible he got extra information. God may have sent him to do this. The core steps were accomplished, right? He did all those core things. But we still have to think about the practicality of the text told us, this is what I want you to do, and he did something extra. You know, he did what for whatever unknown reasons. But we don't know. But here's some things we do know. We do know and learn that whatever's in that extra fits the prophecy that was back in 1 Kings chapter 21. And in 1 Kings chapter 22, as this is being declared, is also the time that Ahab dies. Jezebel is still alive at this time frame, so Ahab's lineage still remains. And so we still have to ask the question, is this his own invention? Is he doing it for vengeance? It's possible. So he met the standard, but then he exceeded the standard in some way. And you got to think about all that that may entail. Because we understand that this is part a person who's part of the school of the prophets. That's what the term sons of the prophets really implies. It's someone who is part of this. Further, this actually also is the time period when Elisha starts to diminish. From this point forward, Elisha is no longer a primary player in the events of Israel. So there's a lot of transition that takes place there. If you're curious, there's a lot of other anointing events in the Old Testament. We're familiar with many of them. Solomon, 1 Kings chapter 1. This one in with Jehu, 2 Kings 9. Joash will appear in 2 Kings 11. And Jehoahaz in 2 Kings 23. That's the 5-minute notice. And so let's keep that in mind too. Let's go ahead though and add one more section of reading to close this out. And that's verses 11 through 13. Mac, would you read that for us if you could?
When Jehu came out to the servants of his master, they said to him, "Is all well? Why did this mad fellow come to you?" And he said to them, "You know the fellow and his talk." And they said, "That is not true. Tell us now." And he said, "Thus and so he spoke to me, saying, 'Thus says the Lord, I anoint you king over Israel.'" How far?
Just to verse 13.
"Then in haste every man of them took his garment and put it under him on the bare steps, and they blew the trumpet and proclaimed, 'Jehu is king.'"
All right, so let's pause for a moment and think about this. What's going on here? What do they perceive the prophet to be?
A maniac.
What'd you say, Bill?
Sort of mad fella.
A mad fella. I love that reading of it on a personal level. How are the prophets generally seen? Is that normal for a prophet to be seen that way?
No.
They're kind of all over the place, right? Some of them are court prophets who are near equivalent in royal standing. Very John-like. How is John seen by the leadership? Crazy weirdo out in the woods, right? The common people receive him gladly. But to these guys, dude, that mad fella, what'd he tell you? How do they respond to his message, though? Yeah, they wanted the message. We're not so sure what they felt about the messenger. And that's an important thing to think about, too, because that's pretty normal. The message is always evaluated differently in the text than the messenger. Sometimes messengers are treated like garbage. Sometimes they're treated like kings. In Elisha's life, he received both of those things. He was also tried to bribe him with tons of cash in different spots. But his messages were linear. God is doing a thing. God is doing a thing. God is doing a thing. Even the secondary message, because as far as we can read, the primary message comes from God to Elisha, and that it's sublet. Go do this thing. For reasons not specified in the text. What'd you guys like? Didn't like? Last seconds of questions. We got 3 minutes, and so you guys get to talk.
I got one.
wondered about why Gehazi was still, would be talking to the king while he was still Elisha's servant after he was told he would have leprosy, unless maybe Elisha prolonged that till after he was out of the picture and then the leprosy came. I know we're not told, it just seems strange that we're used to things going in sequence.
Right, that's why I think a lot of the prophetic space things that we saw are not necessarily in specific order. They are in important narrative order, not in this day, this day, this day, this day order. And so there might be some sequencing issues there with that few chapters of 2 Kings. What else of interest? What didn't you like? I'll tell you what I didn't like is the consequence of rebellion for the people of Israel. The people go into captivity. Not all of them are bad. In fact, many of them are righteous people now having to carry the massive weight of others' rebellion. That's the groundwork that we kind of find in those people that are Daniels, are others that would be rising into prominence later, like Nehemiah. They're not the ones who did the awful thing, but they certainly do have to deal with the consequences of someone else's behavior. And that's I don't like it, like just on a fair level. I appreciate the wisdom behind it at times. I can understand what that does to advance the story of Israel, but it's a painful part of the story. All right, last one.
I was just going to say that God's relationship with man is on a familial level. Yeah. He's our father, we're his children. And how many times have you punished all your children because you can't figure out who did what? The innocent get punished with the rebellers. I mean, that's just...
Yeah, this has been recorded, and so I'm going to answer that hasn't very happened at all. But after the recording is done, then I'll be more clear. No, most certainly in every household there is the uniform discipline code. When you're uncertain who caused it, all suffer. And the intention is that maybe everybody will learn the appropriate lesson. That's it for tonight. We'll continue and step back in to the middle of the 9th chapter, hopefully next Wednesday night. Thanks, everybody.